from Jersey Shore to Mount Pleasant, Altoona to Lebanon, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States has upheld the constitutional right of public employees not to be forced into being a member of a labor union. But unions are actively working to prevent workers from exercising that right. David Taylor of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here to host a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion. And the religious intolerance of the left was on full display last week as Democrats attacked a Republican lawmaker who offered a routine Christian invocation. I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. Democrats have taken another bite out of the Republican majority in the Pennsylvania Senate by flipping a suburban Pittsburgh district in a special election held this past week. Democrat Pam Iovino defeated Allegheny County Republican Party Chairman Dee Raja to win the 37th district seat, vacated by Republican Guy Reschenthaler, who resigned in January to take a seat in Congress. Going into last November's elections, the GOP held a 34-16 seat majority in the upper chamber. But after losing five seats in that election and now with the loss of the 37th district seat, Democrats have 22 seats and Republicans have 26 seats, with two seats vacant. Both of the vacant seats are in heavily Republican territory, and when they are filled by special election in May, will likely boost the GOP back into a 28-22 seat majority. Speaking of those special state Senate elections, Republicans in the 33rd district, which covers parts of Adams, Cumberland, Franklin, and York counties, have selected retired Army Colonel Doug Mastriano as their nominee. The seat is vacant due to the unexpected resignation in January of former Senator Rich Alloway. Mastriano was a candidate for Congress last year, losing in a six-person primary to replace retiring Congressman Bill Schuster. Democrats have nominated Sarah Hammond, who is Director of Community Development for the borough of Spring Grove. That special election, along with one centered in Indiana County, will be held in conjunction with the May primary. In other special election news, Butler County Republicans have nominated Marcy Mostello as their nominee for the 11th State House seat. Mostello works as a scheduler for Congressman Mike Kelly. She will face Democrat Sam Doctor, who is a steel worker. The seat is vacant due to the resignation of former State Representative Brian Ellis, who left office in the midst of sexual assault allegations. Ellis is a Republican. The district is heavily Republican, so Mostello enters the contest as a favorite. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Last June, the Supreme Court of the United States issued a landmark ruling in the case of Janice v. AFSCME that affirmed the First Amendment right of public employees not to be forced for any reason into paying money to a labor union as a condition of employment. But Pennsylvania public employees unions are actively working to subvert that right. Here to talk about it is our Capitol Watch crew, David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, Rebecca Euler from the National Federation of Independent Business, and Matt Briat from the Commonwealth Partners, the Chamber of Entrepreneurs. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Rebecca Euler, Legislative Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Rebecca, thank you for being on the program.
Very happy to be here again. Thanks.
And also glad to have Matt Briat, President and CEO of Commonwealth Partners, the Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Matt, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you both.
So, you know, as ever, we've got a ringside seat for the circus that is a state government in Pennsylvania, Harrisburg, PA. And every once in a while, you see something that comes along and you just ask, well, why is that a big deal? Like, why is that controversial? People are all up in arms about something. You look, you go, huh, what? And so here's one for the listeners today. So in every workplace that I've ever been, there have been all kinds of like mandatory posters with all kinds of different things about, you know, your rights and you know, emergency numbers and all the different policies and things of your employment. This is like standard.
Standard.
Yeah.
Well, so now that the Supreme Court has ruled that public employees cannot be compelled to be a member of a union or pay money to a union as a condition of having their jobs, why would state government not want to inform people of their rights? It's bizarre. Isn't that bizarre? Is it just me, or is that like really just strange? People have these rights, but we're not supposed to tell them about it.
Well, the problem, David, of course, is that those who profit off of or used to profit off of compulsion in union membership or dues or fair share fees, they don't want a lot of people to be able to exercise their First Amendment rights again, and that being freedom of association. And with the extraordinary amount of power and leverage that the public sector unions have over their employers, that being we, the taxpayers, yes, and elected officials, they have been able to thwart this kind of notification of public employees' rights that the Supreme Court recognized once again. I mean, these were rights, of course, that were taken away in the 60s and 70s. And it's a restoration of those rights. And so that you got a lot of people who have gotten quite wealthy, financed operations through compulsion, and they'd rather not people know that they don't have to pay those monies anymore.
This is why our friend State Representative Kay Klunk from York County has introduced legislation that would require public employees to be informed of their rights.
Yes, that's right. House Bill 785, Representative Kate Klunk's bill, would do a couple of things. It would mandate that government employers have to notify their non-union members every year that they are not required to pay anything to the union as a condition of employment. And they're also it would also require government employers to notify new applicants to a job that they're not required to join the union or to pay union payments as a condition of their employment. So the other thing that it does, one more thing that it does, is actually repeal the provisions of Pennsylvania law that are in conflict with the Janus decision from last year. So these seem like pretty basic changes that should be made. I'm like you, David. I'm not sure why they're so controversial.
Yeah, it's like saying, you know what, we don't need to repeal in state law, you know, the things about slavery because we have an amendment to the U.S. Constitution outlawing it, so we don't need to worry about it. And that's essentially what the unions are saying, is that, yeah, don't worry about these laws that aren't in compliance with the Supreme Court ruling. And I think it's in part where they hope that maybe one day, you know, they'll have the Janus court ruling overturned, and that they won't have to go back and address these things in statute. Yet it is pretty amazing. They are fighting, you know, tooth and nail against any of these changes that, as you noted, Dave, at the beginning, this should just be common sense, right? I mean, First Amendment rights should be extended, and everybody should understand what they look like in the workplace.
Surveys have shown that about a third of government employees don't know their rights under Janus. So clearly there's a need for them to be informed.
We've used the name Janus. We're talking here about Mark Janus, who was the litigant, the person who brought suit, that he's a former public employee from the state of Illinois, and that he said that it was a violation of his First Amendment right of freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of conscience to be compelled to pay money to an organization that that he disagreed with, as the public policy agenda of these government unions, these bureaucrat unions. You know, it's inherently in their nature that they want higher spending and more government, and of course then pursuing specific policy particulars. And he said, I ought not to be compelled to support that. And the Supreme Court agreed and said that he doesn't.
It actually took that a step further, David, because folks that didn't like the union, they were told, well, you don't have to be a member, but you get to pay 75-80% of a dues-paying member's fees, what they called the fair share fee. And what Mark Janus said is that, look, even when you force me to pay that fair share, that part that you say is, yeah, supposed to go just for collective bargaining, and I don't get you know, the benefits of being a member, he said that when you compel me to do that, you are still violating my First Amendment rights, because everything you do is political. Even when you negotiate for higher salaries, that has a political component to it, because it necessarily requires higher taxes from the taxpayer when you negotiate that way. So that was what was key in this, was it said, look, you can't compel any employee in the public sector to pay a union anything that they do not consent to paying. And so it struck that down. It went from having to, you know, pay 75% to zero. And this is why the unions don't want everybody to know about this, is because if they don't have to pay, we know that there's a lot of folks who would exercise those First Amendment rights and say, well, I don't want the union representing me. And if I can get 100% refund of, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars, we know that there's going to be a lot of teachers and public employees that exercise those First Amendment rights.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers. With me, Matt Briette from Commonwealth Partners and Rebecca Euler from NFIB Pennsylvania. The public sector was never meant to be unionized in the first place. That the industrial unions, union leaders who founded the 20th century labor movement, people like Franklin Roosevelt, recognized that unionism was the employer and the employee and the battle over who should get how much of the earnings of the industry, but that in government, there are no profits.
Yeah.
There are no profits. There is no risk reward, from the government enterprise, and therefore that they recognize that this would just be, leverage to coerce money from the taxpayers, and that's why those founding labor leaders didn't want the bureaucrats to be unionized.
Well, you noted Roosevelt, the AFL-CIO, they were all opposed to collective bargaining in the public sector, and it really wasn't until the 1950s that opinion began to shift, as you saw a decline in private sector union membership. It was only then that you began to see support for public sector unionization. But I think it's important. I want to underscore, David, what you were talking about, why Roosevelt opposed public sector collective bargaining, is because he recognized that government is a monopoly. And it's whether it's the schools or public transit system.
County courthouse. County courthouse. State agency.
That's right. It is a monopoly of a particular service. And if you allow the workforce in a government monopoly to unionize and collectively bargain, you have effectively handed over control of that monopoly to a private organization.
Yes.
Because remember, these unions are private organizations. And if those union members, those employees, are able to shut down that public service, whether it's your schools or your public transit, you name it, you have empowered a private organization with the power of government.
Right.
And so that it makes logical sense. And it was why Roosevelt, all of the private sector unions, but again, when they started to see membership decline, that's when they shifted. And I think we paid a big, big price for allowing what to happen that a lot of Democrats were opposed to.
Yeah.
And well, to take what Matt's saying a step further, too, the fact that they are a monopoly and therefore have the ability to advocate for things that are in their direct interest. And in the case of a lot of policies, things that increase government spending and increase government power and therefore harm the private sector. So by allowing
reduce
them
liberty.
Yeah. Right. And by allowing them to have sort of this monopoly of lobbying power, they're shutting out other voices. They're important in the public debate, too.
Well, remember, they can use these dues dollars for politics to help elect the very people that they will then go negotiate with across. So it's not often that the employee effectively gets to pick their employer who they then negotiate salary
right.
and benefits. And so it's become this cycle that, of course, it's why we've got governments at all levels. They're looking at bankruptcy. They simply have overextended themselves because of promises particularly made to the unions at the bargaining table. And so not often do I say FDR was right, but he was absolutely right when it comes to what would happen in the public sector when you allow for collective bargaining.
Well, and also that the modern labor movement now is predominantly in the public sector space. And so to have the rights of individuals recognized by the high court in public employment, that this is a very serious threat. With voluntary unionism, with voluntary association, the organization that is seeking members has to convince that individual that forking over your time and your loyalty and your cash is in your own interest. Unions earn members the way businesses earn customers.
Or the way that I choose to join the NRA. I'm not compelled to pay money to the NRA on an annual basis, but I appreciate the value that they give me as a gun owner. And so I voluntarily join. It should be the same thing for the NEA. The NEA ought to be exactly the same, the National Education Association, where teachers voluntarily join because they see value that the union provides. But because they've been able to have this compulsory unionism for many, many decades, well, you can understand why they don't want to give that up.
Having that power to compel, it has increased radicalism on the part of the union leaders, because they're not accountable to their members. People have no choice but to fork over their money and their allegiance, and therefore the leaders are not accountable, and that's led to increasing extremism, I would say.
Right. I think that's true. I think that allowing members to choose whether or not to join a union is going to put the union more in touch with their members' thoughts and feelings on specific policies, hopefully, rather than having this sort of, like you said, extreme policymaking, extreme views on things. Hopefully, they'll be motivated to actually have a more dynamic conversation with their members about what they would like them to advocate.
Yeah, we know that internal surveys of teachers shows that they represent kind of the general population, that, third Democrat, third Republican, a third Independent. Yet, when you look at their financial contributions, it's like mid 90% towards one particular party. And so if you had more voluntary association, it would be very likely that the association would actually represent the views of the membership, rather than it being the bosses of the association who direct all of that compelled money to their causes that they deem most appropriate.
Yeah, and again, this isn't directly related to our conversation here, but also with the public schools, that yes, it's perfectly understandable why a teacher would want to have a say in the operation of his or her workplace, why you would care about what goes on in your building, in your professional environment. But NEA, you're not allowed to just join the local. You have to join PSEA in Harrisburg and NEA in Washington, and that you have those organizations who are involved in a whole panoply of issues that have nothing to do with the operation of that teacher's school buildings, school district, and again, one of those issues that PSEA, NEA, is militantly pro-abortion. And of course, the abortion issue is very divisive, and it has nothing to do with the operation of a classroom. Why should teachers be compelled to support an organization that's taking stands on all these issues unrelated to their profession? If we had voluntary association, voluntary unionism, you would not have, I don't believe, organizations that would be so radical and so far afield.
Yeah, I think that's true. I also think, you know, as an example, some of the policies that unions and even in Pennsylvania have pushed for, which I think have a really bad impact on some, you know, specifically speaking from small businesses standpoint, but the private sector generally, unions have pushed for minimum wage increases, for example. They've pushed for labor mandates like predictive scheduling and mandatory sick leave, things like that that aren't relevant directly to what their members do on a daily basis and in the public sector, but they do really impact the private sector, and they would impact small businesses. So I think you're right. These are issues that you know, typical teacher might not be invested in a school, but they are things that their unions are advocating for and things that really impact the private sector.
And this is how you would increase accountability by, you know, but again, you know, making unionism voluntary. And again, that's what we're talking about with Janus rights. It was only in the public sector space that that private unions and collective bargaining completely untouched by this decision. And you know,
well,
again,
and it was shown, David, to be necessary because Wendell Young of the UFCW, which is the liquor store union, he's the liquor store union boss, has been misinforming liquor store clerks about their Janus rights. And so that became, demonstrated why this was necessary for public employees to be informed of their rights because the unions have been misinforming employees.
And again, transparency, accountability, and just informing people of facts about, you know, the current state of the law. It seems like this should be pretty easy, but again, we're talking about Pennsylvania, so nothing's allowed to be too terribly easy on that. So anyway, well, that brings us to the end of the time that we have. We want to thank Representative Klunk for her leadership on this effort. And I want to thank you folks for being on the show with me. Matt, where can people go to learn more about you and your organization and the things that you're doing?
Yeah, go to facebook.com Commonwealth Partners and join the conversation there.
Outstanding. Rebecca.
They can check out the National Federation of Independent Business at nfib.com/PA or on Facebook or Twitter.
Awesome. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network Sunday mornings at 8:30 for PMA Perspective. So from Rebecca and Matt and me, thank you all very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Since the days of Benjamin Franklin, sessions of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives have opened with a prayer. Until a few days ago, that tradition was void of controversy. Then a fundamentalist prayer sent the left into meltdown. In an enthusiastic but otherwise boilerplate Christian prayer, lasting under 2 minutes, State Representative Stephanie Borowitz triggered a nationwide uproar. Her transgression? She prayed to Jesus on a day when the first Muslim was being sworn into the state house. Now, you would think that a day featuring both a Christian prayer and the swearing in of a Muslim would be the very epitome of inclusion. But the left demands not diversity. They demand strict adherence to their speech codes. Fail to do that, and their outrage machine goes into high gear. And that is exactly what happened. Governor Tom Wolf claimed he was horrified by the Jesus-praising prayer. In a supreme act of religious intolerance, Representative Kevin Boyle walked out of the chamber as other Democrats booed the invocation. Representative Movita Johnson-Harrell, whose swearing in that day sparked the controversy, said she was offended and called upon the House to censure Borowitz. Later, on Facebook, Johnson-Harrell actually called the Christian prayer idiotic. All of this led to the predictable debate over so-called separation of church and state. Social media was ablaze with leftists proclaiming the U.S. Constitution mandates such separation. They accused Representative Borowitz of violating that principle. The words separation of church and state, of course, appear nowhere in the Constitution, which actually prohibits two things. First, it says, quote, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. England had a state religion. Having just won a war of independence, the framers of the Constitution wanted to ensure religious freedom in America. They did this by prohibiting the federal government from establishing an official state religion. The First Amendment then continues, quote, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, end quote. Thus, the suggested censure of Representative Borowitz would be a clear and gross violation of her constitutional rights. Calls by Representative Boyle and others to establish guidelines, which, by the way, is left speak for speech code, also tramples the free exercise of religion. Boyle argues that each day's invocation should be inclusive. Setting aside the impossibility of including every religion in every prayer, there is no compelling reason for self-contained inclusion in each day's invocation. In the fullness of a legislative session, all religions should be and are given the opportunity to be represented, and each should pray according to their religious beliefs. Thus, an imam can and did offer a Muslim prayer. A rabbi can offer a Jewish prayer, and a Christian is free to invoke the name of Jesus, a basic element of our faith. At its core, this entire uproar is the latest effort by the left to scrub religion entirely from the public square. Religion stands in the way of making government the central force in our lives. Therefore, they want Christians to confine their expressions of religious beliefs to Sunday mornings, preferably in a church outside of public view. Calls for eliminating the invocation entirely reveal their mistaken belief that the Constitution requires freedom from religion. There is no such guarantee, implicit or explicit. What the Constitution clearly does is safeguard the freedom of religion. It is that right the left is seeking to take away. The House of Representatives is the people's house, and Christians have a right to be heard in that house, as do, of course, those of other religions. It is not necessary for a Christian invocator to limit the number of times the name Jesus is said, nor alter their prayer just because those of other religions are present. And so the intolerant left seized on a brief prayer and turned it into their latest crusade against the Christian religion. A national tumult ensued, complete with misleading headlines in the mainstream news media, deliberate distortion and mischaracterization of the invocator's remarks, and the predictable lamentations of the perpetually offended. None of this changes the timeless guarantees ensconced in the U.S. Constitution, protecting the rights of all, including Christians, to freely express religious beliefs. Eternal vigilance, as Thomas Jefferson once observed, is the price of liberty. It is a price we clearly must continue to pay if we are to protect our freedom of religion. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WMCE-FM in Erie, WGET-AM and WGTY-FM in Gettysburg, along with 5DRadio.com in Fraser, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.